Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio.
Welcome to Legal Face Off, WGN Radio and WGNRadio.com. The Legal Eagles are here, Rich Linkoff and Tina Martini. So good to see you both.
Good to see you.
Hello,
excited
Pam.
For another show.
That's right. We've got a lot of big legal news developing over the last week. First up, Steven Greenberg, a criminal defense attorney in Chicago, defending clients charged with serious crimes since 1986, including R&B star R. Kelly. Steve, thanks for being with us.
You're making me feel really old when you say that.
I got it from your website. So, Stephen, earlier this week, on behalf of R. Kelly, you made a filing with the court to get permission for him to travel to Dubai next month so that he can perform in some concerts that had been previously scheduled. Can you tell us more about this filing and the reasons for it?
Sure. One of the issues that all defendants have, and in some ways it's gotten better over the years, but in many ways it's gotten worse, is that their freedom of movement when an accusation is made is severely restricted. Now, with people who get put on electronic monitoring, they can't work, or they get their movement restricted to the state of Illinois. They can't move about. They may have a job that requires them to go out of town and so forth. When you've got someone like R. Kelly, you've really got a unique set of circumstances because you've got an individual who, by his very nature, by the very nature of what they do, has to be able to move about, has to play concerts, has to be able to go to meetings, has to collaborate with other people. And he's unable to do that unless he's allowed to travel. Now, the other problem that he's had is since last year, he's had trouble securing venues to perform at here in the U.S. The two examples we cite in our motion are venues here in Illinois. He was supposed to headline this April a show in Springfield at the Illinois State Fairgrounds, and the state government won't give the permit to use the fairgrounds, to use the facility there, the auditorium or whatever it is, with him on the bill. They claim it's a security risk. I don't know why they think it's a security risk, but they think it's a security risk. Last year he was supposed to play UIC, and after tickets had been sold for the show, UIC decided they didn't want to let him use the pavilion for the show. It's really contrary to the presumption of innocence, and it's unfair. So he has to go where he can find shows.
Steve, what can you tell us about the case, the evidence? It's obviously, been well covered so far. It will be, covered extensively as we go forward. We had Michael Avenatti on, who is, I know, one of your besties, on recently telling us his perspective and obviously what he thinks the tapes reveal. Where can you, or how can you bring us up to speed on what you think the evidence will reveal once this case goes to trial?
Well, I have no idea because, unlike Mr. Avenatti, I have yet to see any tape. Unlike the prosecution, I have yet to see a tape. I have yet to see a single page of police reports regarding this case. So I don't know what the facts of the case are. I know what the allegations are. I know who the victims are, the alleged victims in each of the cases. I know what they've said in the past about their relationships, if any, with Mr. Kelly. I know that they've lied. But we're going to wait, and we're going to decide the facts in the courtroom. But let me address Mr. Avenatti. I don't know Michael Avenatti. As far as I know, at least once upon a time, he was a fine lawyer. He was a very accomplished lawyer. I don't know why he decided to get into the sort of arena of public law like this, sort of like Gloria Allred. Maybe he thinks that he can take over when she eventually retires. But I don't have a problem with the man. I wouldn't operate like he does. I wouldn't sit there. You know, he seems to feel that because he says something, it's fact. Maybe fact, it may not be fact. He's in a unique position in that he's not constrained by rules. He comes in here, and while he's an attorney, and he has the title of an attorney. He's not an attorney involved in any case. He's not an attorney subject to our rules. We're restricted by what we can say about a pending case. Prosecutor's restricted. I'm restricted. You guys can say whatever you want about the case. He can say whatever he wants about the case. So I'm not in a fight with him because it's not a fair fight. I can't say anything back. And even if I could say anything back, I don't care what Michael Avenatti thinks of the evidence. I don't care what you guys think of the evidence. I don't care what the media thinks of the evidence or the public at large. All I care about is when the evidence gets heard in court, what the judge or jury thinks about the evidence.
So, Stephen, I just have a couple of follow-up questions.
By the way, that's why we call it Legal Face-Off. We love it. Great answer.
Bam, bam. So, Stephen, you actually have said in the press that, you know, there are a number of these allegations, the latest allegations against your client, that were investigated years ago, and that they were, that the charges were not brought at the time, and on this basis, it's inappropriate to be bringing them up again. You have also mentioned that you think that State's Attorney Kim Fox's desire for the spotlight and desire to jump on the Me Too bandwagon may be part of, you know, the impetus for the latest set of charges. Do you care to comment on that?
All I can tell you about that is that Mr. Kelly was prosecuted back in the early 2000s. I think that case was filed in 2002. It was a not guilty verdict after a jury heard all of the evidence in 2008. And none of these people came forward during that time. You would think that when he was getting prosecuted back then, if they'd have known about something, they would come forward. Let me correct that. One of them did come forward, is my understanding. On one of the particular complaints that are now at issue, I think she came forward in 2002 or 2003. And my understanding from people who were involved back then, because again, I haven't seen any police reports, was that those allegations were investigated and a decision was made not to bring any charges, that they didn't think that there was any credibility to those accusations, and that she, in fact, had told people that she was going to try and make some money off of Mr. Kelly. This was the hairdresser lady. Other allegations, you know, there's only one case, one time frame that postdates his acquittal in the earlier case, and that's, as they like to call it, JP. She's written a book where she's come right out and said she lied about her age. She said she lied to get into court every day. She said she lied to Mr. Kelly. I don't know if he knows her or not, but if he does, she's already admitted lying.
Okay. Stephen Greenberg, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Rich Lenkoff is an insurance defense attorney with Bryce Downey & Lenkoff. Rich is consistently recognized by clients for his outstanding litigation results. In 2015, Target named him their top outside litigation attorney in the country. Rich has received a number of industry accolades, including Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 through 2018 and Leading Lawyer from 2012 through 2018, designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, including serving on the Lincoln Park High School Local School Council, the Advisory Board of Legal Prep Charter Academy, and the Board of Visitors for the Northern Illinois University College of Law. In addition to his full-time legal practice, Rich is a producer with credits, including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring former President Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka, and Renegades, a live show production at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon. In addition to co-hosting Legal Face-Off since 2013, Rich is the legal analyst for several WGN shows, including The Bill and Wendy Show and Patty Vasquez with Andrea Darlis. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional liability, business transactions, construction law, and intellectual property. For more information about Rich and Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, please visit bdlfirm.com.
Kevin Durkin is a partner at Clifford Law Offices, and he is one of the foremost experts in aviation litigation. Thanks so much for joining us, Kevin.
You're very welcome.
Kevin, so Boeing, obviously, local company in the news. They're going to probably get sued, inevitably, from the Ethiopia crash. They have been sued by the estates of several of the victims in the Indonesia crash from October. Could you bring us up to speed on what these lawsuits look like, what you have to prove, and also what the potential recovery is? I know that's a long question. We've got a short time, but give our listeners a sense of how these lawsuits go.
Yes, the lawsuits that are filed involving international transportation against Boeing have been and can be brought in Chicago because Boeing's corporate headquarters is here, okay? That's in distinction to cases against the actual air carriers who, because of international travel, the jurisdictions are limited by the Montreal Convention. But for actions against Boeing, they can be brought here. The fight in each of them is Boeing brings a motion to transfer to the country where the accident took place under the doctrine of forum non convenes. So that's usually the fight. If the plaintiffs are successful, they're entitled to whatever law applies to their case. If it's Illinois law, no caps, damages, full wrongful death damages, loss of society companionship, and economic loss, and grief and sorrow.
So walk us through what the plaintiffs are trying to prove against both Boeing and against the individual airlines that are being sued in this case. You've handled dozens, hundreds of these kind of cases. What are you trying to prove to a jury in these type of lawsuits?
Well, the fact is that very few have ever gone to a jury, but with Boeing, it's purely a strict product liability action, which means they have a product that's either that's defective. They sold a product that was defective, and you know, if it's true, which appears to be very clear, that they have a defective sensor in their anti-stall feature on the 737 MAX, they're going to be held liable. There's no question about that, okay? The plane should not dip its nose on its own, you know, and take the plane into the ground. They're not supposed to do that. Now, that's different than the airline, because this is international travel. It's covered by the Montreal Convention, and it's a different and that's because the plane was going from Ethiopia to Kenya, and both of them are signatories to the Montreal Convention. Under the Montreal Convention, there's automatic damages of 100,000 SDRs, this European name for some type of it's a standard currency, which comes to about $160,000 currently. However, there are no caps on damages. The only cap can be on damages if the airline can prove that they're completely free of negligence. So the burden shifts, not like to the defendant, to show that they have no negligence. If they have no negligence, then there's no then you can't go above the 100,000 SDRs. If they have 1% of negligence, there's no limitation under the Montreal Convention as to what you can recover. But there's no punitive damages under the Montreal Convention.
Kevin, you are one of the most prominent personal injury attorneys in the city, maybe in the country. Walk us through what it's like prosecuting some of these cases. You know, they're obviously, you're dealing with surviving family members of
yes.
a very difficult tragedy. You're trying to recover as much as you can monetarily for them, but that obviously doesn't end the story. Give our listeners a sense of what it's like dealing with the survivors of tragedies like this.
Well, I mean, it's very similar to, you know, most wrongful death cases, but it just seems it's a special, these folks have a lot of grief in terms of knowing what their loved one went through, and the suddenness and randomness of it when it just happens out of nowhere. And so, you know, we always tell our clients to seek, you know, if they need it, you know, don't be shy to go seek a grief counselor to help yourself. And the airlines have been pretty good in the past about helping with that in terms of since over the last 20 years, they've improved in terms of providing services to people. So that's something to be said, a positive. So basically, listening to them and talking to them, you know, our job is a business decision, and we tell them that this isn't going to bring their loved one back. This is not going to make them happy when they're over, but it's going to compensate them, at least under the law, fully if we do our best.
Okay, Kevin Durkin from Clifford Law Offices. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Okay, bye.
Comp Alliance is unique in the workers' compensation industry in their ability to provide comprehensive managed care services from initiation of a claim to settlement, including 24/7 nurse triage, URAC accredited medical and vocational case management. Their suite of innovative MSP compliant solutions, including fully customizable MSA programs, professional administration, and additional cost avoidance services, simplifies the claims management process. Their focus is retaining accountability, responsiveness, and quality while tailoring their services to meet your needs. For your managed care support needs, contact Comp Alliance online at compalliance.com. Again, compalliance.com.
Bruce Udolph is a criminal offense attorney based in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He served as a prosecutor for nearly 20 years. He was a federal prosecutor for more than 10 years. Thanks so much for being here, Bruce.
Pleasure.
Bruce, so Trump this week, yesterday, I believe, said bring it on. He can't wait to see the report. Of course, no collusion. I'm trying to do my best Trump accent. It's terrible. Will we see the report, first and foremost? What do you think?
I have no idea. I was asked that same question about a month ago, and I basically said no time soon. I just thought they had too many loose ends to tie up.
Well, there have been some indications, or at least people are. I mean, people read everything. I mean, people are obsessed, obviously, with the Mueller report, and people are interpreting, you know, the way that Mueller wears his baseball cap into work as meaning something. And, you know, a couple of people have left the investigation, and they're taking that to mean that it's winding down. What do you think? Is there a way to read this? I mean, you were, you know, in that room, as Pam mentioned. Can we take anything, or is this just people, you know, speculating?
Well, just because someone's leaving the office doesn't necessarily mean anything standing alone. I mean, I take it there are several signs that people are looking at, no one of which is going to mean anything in particular. I still think there's a lot of loose ends that need tying up, but that's contradicted by all the noise I hear in the media suggesting that something is imminent. It still would surprise me if anything were to happen in the next couple of weeks.
So, Bruce, the second million-dollar question, which is, what do you think the report's going to say?
There are two questions, actually. What is the report going to say, and what is Barb going to say to Congress about it?
And who will see it, right? I mean,
right.
whether any of us will see it.
Right, exactly. It's generally the policy of investigators not to make any statements beyond what is recommended in terms of a charging document, which is why Comey's original statement regarding Secretary Clinton was so unusual, because generally speaking, either charge you don't charge, you don't talk about it. And that's the traditional approach. It's my impression that Mueller is a traditionalist in that regard. On the other hand, I mean, so much has been said about this investigation first of all, I assume that he's not going to return an indictment, because at least the DOJ guidelines suggest that a sitting president cannot be indicted. So I wouldn't look for Mueller to blaze new territory by indicting a sitting president. On the other hand, I think that they're probably going to be things contained in that report that suggest that there are grounds for impeachment regarding the conduct of the president prior to the election, and also, perhaps even while he was in office, pertaining to attempts to obstruct justice.
So, Bruce, you worked for the investigator's office that investigated President Clinton for the independent counsel. That started off as one thing, as we know. It started off as a Whitewater investigation, ultimately led to the impeachment of the president. You have said that once you turn over one stone, there are a host of other matters that come to light, and you start uncovering those stones as well. There are many who inevitably will criticize the Mueller report as having nothing to do with the core issue as to whether there was collusion with the Russian government. There are many who are also criticizing the, you know, Northern District of New York or the Southern District of New York looking into Trump's finances. People are criticizing Congress for, you know, starting investigations into all other areas of the Trump world. What is your feeling? Is it still that all of these other areas are relevant, even though Mueller started off looking at one specific thing?
I don't think Mueller has rendered himself vulnerable to criticism for chasing a bunch of other transactions down blind alleys. I mean, basically, if he's turned up information regarding other criminal activity that was not within his original mandate, he's been pretty liberal about handing them off to other offices, such as the Southern District of New York, or to the investigators in D.C. He appears to have basically, you know, stayed pretty close to his mandate and not wandered afar.
So when the report is done, can you walk us through what happens with it after that? How much of it becomes public? What Congress's role is? What the public will get to see and so forth?
Well, generally under the old law, the old independent counsel law, you basically turned over just about everything that you found. Now, there was a lot of that law was allowed to expire basically because of perceived abuses of the Starr investigation and basically turning into what was deemed by a lot of people to be a witch hunt. And so the new policy and procedures that are in place at DOJ are far more restrictive about what gets made public. Basically, what the special prosecutor is supposed to do is to basically summarize the cases that have been indicted, those that have not been indicted, and give reasons for why they have not been indicted, and that's all that is required. Now, whether or not Mueller wants to prepare a speaking, so to speak, report, sort of the way his indictments read, he's at liberty to do that, and he may do that since he doesn't strike me as the kind of prosecutor that's likely to call a press conference and explain why he didn't indict the president. I don't think it's likely to hear Mueller talk about the fact that he didn't indict the president, but here's why he would get indicted if he weren't president or something along those lines. I think what he'll probably do is set forth all of his factual findings in great detail and leave it to Barr to decide, you know, what he's going to release and what he's not going to release. Barr, on the other hand, is subject to different restrictions. I mean, there are certain things that he can't make public. One of them is classified information that's contained in Mueller's report. The other is grand jury material, so-called 6E material, which can be made public by order of a judge. That's really sort of easy to overcome. The toughest one to overcome, though, is information that he may withhold from the public because they pertain to pending investigations, either in some district of New York or the District of Columbia or whatever other jurisdictions they've shared information with and the special counsel has worked with during the course of its investigation.
Bruce Udall, thank you for joining us.
A pleasure.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
And now the segment we've all been waiting for, the last segment of our show, the legal grab bag here on Legal Face-Off. We have WGN Radio's Bob Coyne.
Yay, Bob Coyne, finally on the other end of the mic.
Right.
Thank you for having me.
Are you nervous, Coyne?
No.
Senior sales executive.
Is it Coyne's first time on the air at WGN? No, it can't be.
No.
Didn't your host like a... Did you host like a hobby show back in the late 80s about like kites and balloon making or something?
Woodshop.
On another radio station I was
involved
in. And
he's a film star,
shopping.
Too.
Puppeteering with Bob Coyne.
You're a film star as well, right?
Midnights. Yes. Midnight to 2 on WGN Saturday nights in 97. No. Not a very successful show.
Never was a DJ.
First ever podcast on WGN, Bob Coyne hosted.
I believe so, yes.
All right, very good.
And attorney Michael Milstein of the illustrious Bryce Dowdy and Lincoln.
Illustrious, famous,
well-known,
all that.
First time, long time.
Calling from Northbrook. Go ahead, Northbrook. Hello.
Maybe how I'm talking.
Topeka, hello. I do a Larry King. Mm-hmm. Arlen Park, go. And also, Michael is the son-in-law of one of Legal Face-Off's most devoted listeners. Shout out to?
Shout out Gail.
Gail.
Nice.
Maybe a future.
Hi, Gail.
A future
maybe
guest?
A future LGB guest right there.
That would be fantastic.
Let's get Gail in.
Let's do it.
This is the official invitation to Gail
Ovadenko.
Ovadenko.
I could use the brownie points.
As a legal grab bag guest.
I'm
you know, will you second that?
Oh, absolutely.
I know, great attorney.
Iowa City, go. I'm just doing the whole thing as Larry King.
You do that.
Oh my
well.
God, please don't.
Remember that column you used to have that was just random thoughts? I remember in USA Today, it was like, what do you need those things on the end of shoelaces for? I really love sausage. It was just Larry King random.
Wow. He's still alive,
it was,
right?
It was all the,
yeah.
It was the dot, dot, dot. It was like, you know.
It's like Mad Lib.
You can see him falling asleep at Dodgers games all the time.
Yeah. That's Larry King married what? A dozen times right now?
Yeah.
Just got married today again. And divorced, same day.
And his kids are about 8 years old.
Which is just creepy.
That is like creepy. Tony Randall. Remember Tony Randall?
Yeah, absolutely.
I didn't remember him as a serial marrier.
Well, he ended up having kids when he was in his
80s. Yeah, like,
oh.
Right.
Wow. Old dad.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Talk about all right. So first up, it's the kind of murder not seen in New York for 35 years. Was it a sanctioned hit or a mob war? That's what investigators are trying to find out after reputed mob boss Francesco Frankie Boy was found with multiple gunshot wounds dead outside of his home, 53 years old.
So, yeah, there are a bunch of conflicting reports as to what exactly this was, whether it was something out of The Sopranos or whether it was a love story gone afoul. So last week, the reputed leader of the Gambino crime family, Frankie Boy Colley, was found shot and killed execution style outside of his New York City home. What happened was...
My favorite type of... That's my favorite style, by the way, of killing.
Execution style. I didn't know that you had such experience in these
matters. I always wonder, are there other styles? How many styles are there? Is it like salad dressing?
You murder suicide?
Well, then they say like gangland style.
Yeah.
So what's the difference?
Lots of different styles, but...
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know.
Well, anyway, so apparently this is an interesting one. So apparently Frankie Boy had his car parked outside his house in the street, and somebody came by and hit it. And the speculation was that this person hit his car thinking he would get Frankie Boy to come out and figure out what was going on. Then there is actually video footage of what happened. So Frankie Boy was then talking to this guy that came up to his front door. They're talking. Then he gets shot at 9 times or 12 times, and then he gets hit 6 times. He dies at the hospital. There's speculation because of some other things that have been going on with the mob world in New York over the past few months that this could be a resurgence of the mob war there. But then Rich, having his finger on the pulse of all things mobster, was telling me earlier that he's heard that this may have been a love triangle.
Yeah, there's
of
some
sorts.
Talk that it's just a lover spat because Frankie Boy didn't want this guy, the alleged shooter, dating his niece, right?
His niece.
I just love the fact that we're back in the era of, you know, mob hits. That's,
I don't know. In Chicago, time. That scares me. I don't know.
I'm hoping that he follows the most important advice that any mobster can hear. Never rat on your friends. Always keep your mouth shut.
Before we go any farther, I just want to say, like, nothing but respect. You know, you don't want to talk bad about the mob.
That's right.
Just nothing but respect.
That's right.
That's the preface to everything here.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm with
Wasn't
you.
Wasn't that Joe Pesci from Goodfellas?
That would be Jimmy Conway from Goodfellas.
Oh, it's Jimmy Conway from Goodfellas.
Teaching
that's
Henry Hill the most important lesson, which is really two things, but the same thing. You know, never rat on your friends, always keep your mouth shut is literally the same thing. Coyne, where do you stand on this?
How does Henry Hill even say a word and still survive? I mean, he does the circuit and he talks to people, and it's like Salman Rushdie, you know?
Right.
I mean, he was on the hit list, and here he is on NBC or, you know, Today Show or whatever. How do these guys, you know, even survive?
A little disrespect, a little bit. It was a little bit.
For a mob boss, it's a really sad way to go out from a kid that wants to, you know, date your niece.
Yeah. There's also a Trump element to the story, right?
Really?
The guy had MAGA on his hands.
Right.
So there's some speculation that's part of the what's that, like, underground movement that there's some discussion that this is part of the whole Trump discussion. So,
man,
interesting. We'll see.
Yeah, he also, there was video of him, like, running underneath, like, trying to get away from the bullets and running underneath his SUV. And that's one of the things that I've gleaned from all the mob videos and the movies that I've watched.
Yeah.
Is, you know, that's not the way you want to go out. You don't want to go out like that.
Yeah, Pam's the mob expert.
No, I'm just saying. I like mob movies, man.
I love them, too.
I thought you said Spider, I was okay. Nah, Spidey, you stuttering mutt. I didn't say that.
You're a
dance for me, Spider, like you dance for them.
And you know who that's Spider good. Later became, right?
Of course.
Christopher,
yeah.
Yeah.
Can we just talk Goodfellas for the next 30
minutes? Can we talk Sopranos?
Yeah, let's talk Sopranos.
I need the knife. It's a sin. He's got the hoof.
He's got the hoof. He's got the hoof caught in the grill. The hoof.
Mom, why don't you settle down?
Great.
I settle down every night. I come back to you. I want to be with you.
Are you getting
delicious.
This?
You're funny like delicious. I amuse you.
You're funny.
Funny how?
Funny how? What do you mean funny?
I woke up in a field. Bang, ping, boom. You saw me. My face was up to there.
Ba-bing,
he's like, what are you doing here? I said, oh.
Did they
what do you have to say? Nothing.
Do you want to be a schnook?
Go F yourself.
Do you want to be a
Bang,
schnook?
Boom.
Is the shooter in custody or is he on the run?
Yeah, he's in custody.
He's in custody. He's smiling for the camera.
Yeah, showed his MAGA stuff.
These impressions are a day in the life.
Right, and that's going to be interesting.
All right, let's go ahead. What do we got next?
All right, we've got a nasty pillow fight between pillow giant MyPillow and a small Michigan.
Nope, we dropped that one because we're dealing with our Van Dyke story.
Yes, going Van Dyke.
Breaking news.
Okay, breaking news. Cut. Crash. Bada bing, bada
and also
boom.
Because I cannot stand, I can't stand the MyPillow guy.
That would have been great fada.
Yeah.
Okay.
Fada.
Hello, mother. Hello,
no, Van Dyke. Van Dyke is back in the news, right?
Yes. Yes. This week, the Illinois Supreme Court denied a request by the state's attorney general to resentence former Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke in the murder of black teenager Laquan McDonald. So the special prosecutor in the case, can you just bring us up to speed on what happened here?
Yeah. So Attorney General Kwame Raoul and special prosecutor Joseph McMahon had been questioning the legality of and seeking to increase the length of Jason Van Dyke's sentence beyond the 81-month prison sentence that he's currently serving. And last week, the Illinois Supreme Court, as Pam mentioned, denied the request without much of an explanation. You know, he had gotten his sentence was really based on the second degree murder sentence instead of a sentence that was based on each of the 16 counts of aggravated battery. And that was what Kwame Raoul and Joseph McMahon had been trying to have his sentence be based on, in which case that would have carried a maximum sentence of 6 years in prison per count, so that Jason Van Dyke would have faced up to 96 years in prison. So there wasn't much of an explanation other than the court saying that it was a discretionary sentence and that it was not a proper venue or form to be reconsidering that. There was also other Van Dyke news last week. He actually moved to another prison, this time in Otisville, New York. Our listeners will remember that a few weeks ago, we had talked about how he had been beaten in the last prison he was at in Danbury, Connecticut. So this Otisville, New York prison is a medium security prison and was listed as listed by Forbes as one of the 10 cushiest prisons in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about the first part of the story, the Supreme Court declining to hear the motion, was that they didn't really give much explanation, which is not that uncommon. I mean, frequently you'll see courts rule and just either defer to the lower court or overturn something. A little disappointing in this case, they didn't give us more detail, because really there's not much case law on whether the judge followed the law in sentencing Van Dyke to such a small amount of years. Obviously, given that story, there's a lot of people who have been upset. Tony Preckwinkle, who's running for mayor in a couple weeks, said, you know, she compared it to the sentence, I think an 85-year sentence of a black defendant who committed murder versus the few years that Van Dyke got. So I think the Supreme Court should have explained their decision more. And it also came down by strict party lines. In Illinois, the Supreme Court, you know, they run for their seat, and it was either a 4-2 or 4-3 decision, and the dissent was all Republican. So I think they should have done their job better and given an explanation to give some guidance in the future to create some precedence on this issue. Milstein, what do you think?
Well,
good decision, bad decision?
Well, I'm not happy the Supreme Court didn't say anything. I think when you look at convictions and sentence terms in Illinois, you always got to compare it to Blago. You know, Blago got 14 years for what he did, and Van Dyke got 6.5 years or so. But I don't think how cushy of the prison is. If there are young African-Americans in that prison, I don't think he's going to be safe. So he can go to anywhere he wants in New York. I still think the people are going to be coming after him because, you know, his case was pretty high profile. So a lot of people are pretty upset about it still.
Pam, Bob, do you think this was political? I mean, there are a lot of people who criticize Kwame Raoul for bringing the case in the first place. You know, he just took office as AG here a few months ago, and it was really the first high-profile decision he made. You know, the judge, as the Supreme Court held, had discretion. They might not have, you know, Raoul might not have liked it in the face of a lot of, you know, pressure. But do you think this was political, or do you think there was actually a legal motive behind it?
I was going to ask you about the legal motive, actually. I guess I really don't understand. How could you challenge the legality of a sentence? I mean, is that common?
Well, you can. I mean, it's not that common in this case. Again, there isn't a lot of case law on it, and the case law did support the idea that the judge had the discretion. You know, there's a lot of discussion about why it's more serious to commit second-degree murder with a gun versus... So that, you know, a lot of legal scholars didn't know the answer to that. And I do think there's a lot of politics that go into it, given how much attention this case received, not just in our city, in an election year, but, you know, across the world, I think.
I think maybe some emotions came into it, believe it or not. Opening that wound again, it's such a difficult case. I think the burden to the prison system, just having this guy housed, is going to be an undertaking. And I just don't think that they wanted to even talk about it anymore.
And for Kwame Raoul, can you imagine what would have happened if things were flipped and he actually got the decision he wanted in the case?
Yeah. Would have been a big win.
Yeah. So... not sure.
For sure.
Yeah. There could be politics in play. All right. So up next, the Flintstones story. Yes.
Everybody loves the Flintstones.
Everybody
right?
loves the Flintstones. It's called the Flintstones House in Southern California. The town is Hillsboro. And that town now throwing some legal stones at a homeowner because of statues.
Oh, I see what you did
there. I like that play on words.
Radio veteran Pam Jones did right there.
Stones. So what do we think about this story? She was a new homeowner, right?
Yeah. So the Flintstones house apparently is pretty well known in Hillsboro and the area around Hillsboro. And what happened was she bought this house recently, the current owner, and, you know, it's already got some kitsch to it. You've got, you know, Fred Flintstone in the front yard, and it's actually a really interesting looking house. What she did was she added to an already existing array of decorations, shall we say. So she added some large dinosaurs to the yard, and the town of Hillsboro said that she did it without the proper permitting. And when she wasn't willing to take down the dinosaurs, the lawsuit was filed. And the lawsuit claims that her, quote, landscaping improvements create a highly visible eyesore and are out of keeping with community standards. And apparently the inspectors had told her she needed to get permission. She didn't get permission. So the lawsuit demands the removal of the dinosaurs. So we see cases like this all the time, maybe not involving the Flintstones house or involving George Jetson's house or anybody else's.
Or Jane, his wife.
Or their boy, Elroy, for that matter. But no, I mean, I think it's an interesting story just because it's one of the more well-known houses apparently in the area, and it's Fred Flintstone.
All right.
I'm looking for
Milstein, Wilma, or Betty? I'm just going to throw it out there.
Betty.
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 Yeah, Betty.
Not a redhead?
Betty, come but on.
Ginger. Betty, but Ginger on the
good. Betty, oh, but Ginger. Marianne, or.
Right, yeah.
You're an enigma wrapped in a riddle, Bob.
Right. Actually, it's one of the, you know, there's actually been a spate of issues involving homeowners suing each other and homeowners associations. More specifically, there's one going on in Arizona. And it's interesting because it's, you know, usually rich white people who are fighting each other about whether they can put up things on their property. You know, not always, but these cases are, you know, kind of dumb when you think about it. On the other hand, you know, there are some interesting legal issues going on here. But there's a ton of lawsuits involving people who don't want to follow rules. Mm-hmm. And then the question becomes, is it a First Amendment issue? Because, mm-hmm. you know, one guy said, I have the right to put up a cross on his lawn, even though that doesn't abide by the HOA rules. So there's a lot of this stuff going on.
Overhanging trees, you know.
Walls, trees. One guy painted his
dog waste,
his house pink, and wants to fight about that. I mean, really? Like, I'm all for lawyers having work to do, but clogging up the legal system with these stupid lawsuits and painting
frivolous.
Your house pink is kind of ridiculous.
Wow. Well, I think sometimes, though, I mean, like when it creates a hazard, right, I think there's certain lines where it's an easier line to see and define. Like when you're creating a hazard such that you may hurt people with things that you put on your property, like overhanging, you know, shrubbery, for example. Yeah. Bring us
well,
a shrubbery.
Well, we've covered it on our show was... Peter Geraci, the bankruptcy mm-hmm. tapes guy, right. His wife was in a long lawsuit against a high rise right here by the lake because she wanted to. I think it was her suing the association because of a dog issue. I think her dog bit someone or mm-hmm. she got bit, and it was this like years long lawsuit mm-hmm. involving Geraci against the homeowners association.
I remember that. Yeah.
Wow. I'm looking for a place to move right now. I know Hillsboro is definitely off the list.
No.
You don't want to be your neighbor?
But, like, when I'm looking for a house, like, one of the houses we want to see, you need to put up a fence. We want to put up a fence. Mm-hmm. And we were told the hoops that you would have to go through in the town to put up just a simple fence so my mm-hmm. dog could run around with it would have been such a major obstacle to achieve that we said we're not going to have to deal with that. So I sort of do understand, you know, partly that a town doesn't want them to have these type of what they call eyesores, which is absurd. But, you know, you got to know that the rules are going right. to come down on
the
you.
The bylaws
when you start doing this.
And the ordinances right. are there for reasons. I mean, even Red Roof Inn can't put a red roof on their hotel in Naperville. Mm. McDonald's can't put their arches on certain
roof or towns. Roof?
Roof. Roof.
Are you a rough?
The roof is on
rough
fire.
Guy?
The roof.
Ginger and the roof.
The roof.
The roof. Roof.
Coins are rough. I'm more of a roof.
I haven't heard roof in a long time.
All right, so Flintstones. Pam, where does Flintstones rank in your list of favorite
cartoons.
Animated shows?
I'm a I big. I'm number
I'm,
five.
I'm pro Flintstones. Five, huh? Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Number
Jetson, five.
Jetsons
what?
Is
are you? Are you? No, you're very self-aware. You know, you run
right
to five. Yeah, because I knew it wasn't a one, but it wasn't a ten. So what's one?
five?
I'm going to say Tom and Jerry. I am Tom and Jerry fanatic. Yes. Give me some. Yes.
What about Underdog?
Are you a Tom person or a Jerry person, though?
Both, because Jerry's so cute, but I love Tom.
I'm an itchy and scratchy guy myself.
You know who I don't like? Itchy and scratchy.
Yeah, love
itchy and scratchy.
Scooby-Doo.
I don't like the maid.
Scooby-Doo was great.
Tina, favorite animated show of all time?
I have to say, I love Scooby-Doo. I really loved Underdog.
Mm. Oh, Underdog.
And Sweet Polly Purebred.
Oh. Well, Scooby-Doo was ahead of its time because, you know, Shaggy was high as a kite, right? I mean, nonstop.
True. Yes. True. But no one really knew that's what it was. They just thought he was an airhead.
Oh,
right?
I always knew.
He loved munchies,
see?
And he talked to a dog.
Right? My parents are very southern.
Was he high or not?
I think I'm.
And as a dog kid, as a little kid,
Michael Milstein story.
He's talking that
University
stuff.
Of Illinois, 1997 to 2007.
Wait, he was high?
Right. As a kid, I knew that, man. I was like, oh, that must be what mom and dad say about smoking that stuff.
Yeah. That's
what
but the dog talked back to him.
Only in his head.
Right? Like,
it's like Snuffleupagus.
Only Big Bird. What about Velma?
Babe Big Bird was high the whole time because he only wanted to sell Snuffleupagus.
What about what's his name with a scarf? Fred. Oh, what's the deal? Where's the next arm? Why do they always solve the crime at the end? And what is on and on in the mystery machine?
That's awesome. Yeah,
just had to bring up the sign.
What about Inspector Gadget? Nobody mentioned Inspector Gadget.
Why did he wear the raincoat? Now I can't stop the whole show as I know.
Woody Woodpecker.
Yeah. Woody Woodpecker's great.
Right?
Yeah. Yes.
Awesome.
Although that song got in your head, you can never get it out. You know that. Right.
That's the Woody Woodpecker.
Yogi and Boo Boo.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Boo Boo.
Weird relationship, by the way. As we turn to the Michael Jackson story, very good
thanks,
segue
thanks
from.
Thanks for bringing us down, Rich. We really appreciate it.
There is some similarity to.
It was great.
Boo Boo and Yogi relationship, perhaps. But
Yogi and Michael Jackson.
Let's talk about Jacko.
Actually, you know what? You have seen this, so I'm going to let you intro this. How about that?
Yeah, Finding Neverland. I'm maybe 90 minutes into the first episode. I think there's two. I think it's 6 hours or so. We have covered it on our show. Really compelling stuff. Of course, it features two alleged victims of Michael Jackson. They are alleging that he sexually abused them when they were 7 and 10 years old. You know, his estate has denied it. There has been, you know, I mean, Twitter is going crazy about this issue. It's really compelling, you know. I think just as a pure documentary, whether you believe them or not, it's just really well made. But the stories are incredible. I mean, I find them very believable. I find them very credible. You know, as someone who, you know, we all deal with witnesses all the time, and I think I'm pretty good at determining credibility. I think they're credible. You guys have not seen it yet, I understand?
No, have not seen it. We covered this story a few weeks ago, and there's a lot of press and a lot written about how people are doubting the credibility of the two people who are featured in the film. One in particular who I think has had a rough go of it the past few years, and people are believing that maybe he's making up at least part of the story to cash in on it. But I have to tell you, I have talked to people who have seen it, who are some good friends of mine, who have said that after seeing it, they believe 100% in what these folks are saying.
Well, remember, we've covered, you know, every kind of sexual abuse and harassment story over the years, and inevitably the accusers get called out as, you know, they're looking for fame or money or why didn't they report earlier. And, you know, as we've heard on our show from experts who deal with this area, it's hard to come forward. The fact that you haven't come forward in many years doesn't mean that your story is less credible. And, you know, why would anyone want that kind of fame? I mean, show me an example of someone who's accused someone famous of abusing them, turning that into some kind of lucrative career. Like,
that's true.
You know, it's not happening. So I think they're very believable. It's a really compelling story, and you know, we're not going to see the end of it. I think
it's so sad. From the people that have watched this, I've heard arguments from them, you know, about who's at fault here. Of course, Michael Jackson would be at fault, but what about the families of the kids?
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I texted one of my coworkers who watched the movie, and that's exactly what I said. I said it was, my first reaction wasn't how bad Michael Jackson is, even though he's a deplorable human being, in my opinion. I texted this guy and say, how could the mothers have let this happen? Because the mothers on film are saying, you know, one of them comments on how much she liked the wine cellar and she liked, you know, walking around with him and being in the spotlight and how intoxicating that life was.
Right.
Yeah. How about not letting your son go to bed with Michael Jackson?
Maybe see, that's, I don't get that at all.
That's
maybe
what
that's
I
like
it.
Step
Michael
one.
Jackson, though. It's not like some random guy on the street. This is
but
Michael
still.
Jackson.
Right.
Most famous man in the world.
Yeah.
All of a sudden is now, you know,
But there's some level of trust.
I get
you know,
still.
The guy's in their living room every day. The kid was obsessed with and they said he's almost part of the family. That's why they trusted him. But
yeah,
by the way,
the weird
he's some
uncle.
Strange adult.
Yeah. One of the kids grew up to marry one of my best friend's cousins.
Oh.
One of the two.
Really?
Oh. Wow.
I haven't, like, researched it all and, like, talked to that guy about it, but...
But you're right, Pam. I mean, I think, you know, the parents do have a lot to answer for. You know, they're sympathetic. I understand that. But, I mean, they have the grandmother on at one point, and she's talking about, you know, she had never been out of Australia, and it was her first time meeting a celebrity. And, okay, but, you know,
and
watch your kids.
Here's Pam, who doesn't have any kids, never had any, you know, don't have any hopes of having any unless we do a Mary Magdalene thing. but, like, focus on the children. All these outside things that are going on, the fame, you know, intoxicated with the grandiose, the spectacle. I don't care about that. Your one job in this world is to take care of that child. And I mean, I can probably count on my hand the number of sleepovers I was allowed to go to when I was a young child here in Chicago. You
and
know
not
what I mean?
With a fully grown pop star, right?
Exactly. My parents had to know the parents. They, you know, I probably not even five.
So well, I think I heard that one of the kids that their fathers committed suicide.
Oh,
I thought I heard.
So sad. Awful. The whole thing is.
It is.
Well, it's interesting because that in the hour that I've seen, one of them talks about how they wanted Michael Jackson. One of the victims says, "I wanted Michael Jackson to be my father. He called me son." And he says, "No offense to my father, I had no issue with him, but Michael Jackson sort of took that role." So I'm sure that's related to what you're saying.
Have you guys talked about Abducted in Plain Sight on the show?
No, I want to see that
too. Well, because it's sort of the same thing where the parents, like, how do the parents let their kid do what she's doing over and over and over again versus Michael Jackson? But
yeah.
At the same time, you've watched it for an hour, so has your opinion changed that if Billie Jean comes on the radio, are you turning it off?
Right.
Well, we talked about, you know, the Hall of Fame announced today that they're not going to kick Michael Jackson out. Yeah, it's an interesting question. I'm not a huge Michael Jackson fan. Billie Jean was the favorite song of my mom. It was like the one song she loved. So, you know, Thriller was the first cassette I ever bought.
Mm-hmm.
And the Jacksons was the first concert I ever went to in that reunion tour they had in 84. So
I went.
But I'm
I wish I went.
Yeah, I'm not a fan. I mean, you can't be a fan after watching it.
The biggest fall from stardom and the top of the mountain by any human being to
Cosby being a close second, maybe, right?
And I want to say,
Joe Paterno, Pete Rose.
Yeah.
I mean, you could go down the list, but Michael Jackson is going to be way up there for a while. I can't think of anybody else.
Well, R. Kelly.
Yeah. And it was the
not
same.
Not nearly.
Not quite
people are asking the same questions about that case, you know?
Right.
About those parents.
Yes.
What else we got?
All right. So now on to Marilyn Hartman, the serial slipper through airport security artist, who apparently has also slipped her way onto a British Airways flight to London's Heathrow Airport, now sentenced to 18 months probation after pleading guilty to a criminal trespassing charge.
Yeah, I mean, just go away forever.
Stow yourself away forever.
I flew in from Vegas this morning. I think I saw her as I put my luggage in the overhead. I saw a pair of eyes looking out. I'm sure it was her.
Apparently,
she like pushed my bag back out of the overhead.
Since last summer, she's been in a mental health facility, a safe haven, and the judge says that she is very impressed with her record at this mental health facility.
Like, listen, there are enough crazy people on my flight every time I fly. I don't need
she's
more.
She's not on your flight. She's underneath.
No,
she's there.
Perfect. Go away, right? Coined? Enough of the story?
What happened.
She has a chemical imbalance of some kind.
Yeah.
And
good on TSA, though.
Unfortunately,
right.
She can't control herself. Like many other people with many addictions, she has an issue. And I was looking at her pictures today, and it's obvious she's not quite all there. So it's unfortunate she can't stop doing this, but it's...
something in her brain won't let her stop.
Yeah.
I just wonder what would happen to me if I tried to slip past security at one of these airports. I'm trying to tell you, because they put me on a special list. They tell me, oh, you have an extra check and all this other stuff. I'm like, but you let her through. Yeah. What?
Yeah. I'm getting pulled over because my belt buckle goes off.
Right.
And this lady's stowing away on the bottom of an Ethiopian air flight.
I don't understand it because, I mean, like, you think that the TSA agents have some sort of semblance of, you know, trying to look for suspicious activity.
Sure.
She kind of stands out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like, there would be that woman. There she is again. Like, it happens to you once. Okay.
Maybe it happens
twice. All right. But the third time, come on now.
Everyone says, what do you want to do more? I want to travel more. And know what? She traveled.
Yeah. She definitely
does. I'm okay with this.
She's
lady.
Spending her later years traveling.
Oh, my God.
In cargo.
Ridiculous. As cargo. And how do we know she's really not going to do this again? Even the judge doesn't know. She says she doesn't have a crystal ball.
I can guarantee you she's going to do it
again. Of course she's going to do it again. She's getting all this fame and fortune.
She's making nice. Yeah.
I think it should be a reality show where we follow her around.
Yeah.
Like, right?
Yeah. Where is Marilyn?
It's a great idea. We'll talk.
Stowing away with Marilyn Harmon. This week.
That's stowed a great
idea. Stowed away.
What is there?
I like that. We'll have a little hidden camera on her.
And
the TSA agent will say, aren't you? No. All right. So Peloton, the exercise bike commercial with that really cool music. Have you guys heard it? You know, on to the next one or whatever. Apparently, this company has been on to the next thing with thousands of songs they did not have permission to use.
That's alleged. Yes.
Is that alleged?
Well, it's alleged. I mean, so last week, I think it was, the news broke that a group of music publishers were suing Peloton for copyright infringement, claiming that they had used like 1,000 songs without permission. And these are songs by well-known artists like Lady Gaga, Bruno Mars, Rihanna, and a few other folks. So what's interesting is that the National Music Publishers Association is seeking $150 million in damages. Mm-hmm. So this is not something that is just, you know, chump change here. So the president of the NMPA said that he thought it was just incomprehensible that Peloton wouldn't know that they owed money in royalties. A representative for Peloton said, we actually respect the artists, and oh, by the way, we actually partner with each of the major music publishers and record labels and performing rights organizations, and that they have a belts and suspenders approach to licensing of rights. So my guess is that this will settle out of court, but it's just it's interesting when you see companies like Peloton, which is pretty innovative with what they've done, mm-hmm. that this lawsuit for $150 million has been filed against them. So
I think that the music industry is sort of like the mob, to bring it full circle. Like after Napster, back in the day when I was in college, you get everything for free. Nowadays, they have picked up their game. You do not mess with the music industry. You steal one song, they're coming after you.
Oh, yeah.
Whether you're an individual or a large company. So they're an organization you do not want to mess with.
This is true. I have gotten a cease and desist order.
There you go.
Yes, I have. Immediately. I put a clip of a Prince song. It was very innocuous. I saw some snow in April, and he has this song, Sometimes It Snows in April. I shot a little video. I used more than 6 seconds, which is fair use. Mm. And so they had my Instagram, or it was one of my profiles, shut down for a little while. But I emphatically apologized, and, you know.
Well, Prince, it's interesting because Prince, I think, there's like special, it's a special situation because after he passed away, there was a lot of talk about how, like, there are no YouTube videos mm-hmm. or anything streaming his music mm-hmm. because his estate, and before he died, he really, you know, clamped down pretty aggressively on that.
And this was just days before he died that this happened to me. Interesting.
Interesting.
All right, guys. Thank you so much. That's it for this week's Legal Face-Off.
We have one more story.
Wait, I thought we had one more story.
Yeah.
We have March Madness.
I
didn't mean wrap up.
I thought you meant wrap.
Speed up.
All right.
Huh? Yeah, talk about gambling.
Do you have a Peloton?
That's the whole reason Milstein's here.
Oh, okay. Great.
I'm not a biker.
They had an amazing holiday advertising campaign, and we thought about it, buying a Peloton.
Oh, yeah. That was a great.
The music was intriguing. So
yes.
I think $150 million is reasonable.
Hmm.
Yeah.
$150 million is a lot of money. So we'll see what happens. I'm sure they'll settle. I mean, usually these lawsuits end up settling pretty quickly. So,
all right. So March Madness, yeah. Is gambling legal or not? That's the question, right? I mean, we covered the recent Supreme Court decision that basically said that the states have the right to decide whether gambling is legal or illegal in their state. I think only 7 or so have now legalized it. But we have noted gambling expert Michael Milstein in the studio.
So I hate the NCAA.
Uh-huh.
They came out and said how they're in intros to the games, how gambling's wrong, you shouldn't gamble. They even prohibit the players and coaches from talking about lots of different things. But on their website was eight ways to help your bracket.
Nice.
The hypocrisy of the NCAA.
And they're also making, you know,
billions of dollars and not paying the
and
players.
And not paying the players anyway.
So
Coyne, how are we doing on the GN pool? Why is Tina not involved in this? Tina knows every. She's correctly predicted the winners of the last three NCAA finals.
Oh, yeah. I have a gift.
Are we two games in now? I think I've lost them both. So
yeah.
My bracket
Minnesota?
Is busted.
Wow.
And Auburn. And,
yeah. Pam, are you in on the
No,
pool?
I'm not good at that.
No.
You know, no.
Should gambling be legal all across the country?
Yes. Anybody who knows me will laugh at that.
We kind of laugh in the office because during commercials, when we're writing them, we cannot say March Madness. We cannot say Super Bowl.
Gina knows
that. No, you can't. Yeah, I know all about that.
A sponsor of the White Sox can't say the White Sox. You know, if they don't pay the team, they cannot say the Chicago White Sox in their ad. So there are some very strict laws and rules regarding all of this stuff, and it has become big business.
Gina, explain
to our
listeners
why. Do you want to come work with me?
Yeah. Why can't advertisers use the term March Madness, Super Bowl, things
well,
like that?
Because then you end up making people believe that somehow you're a sponsor of them, and their sponsors pay a ton of money to mm-hmm. be entitled to say Super Bowl, March Madness, or that they're affiliated.
And those terms
are
protected.
And those terms are protected. They're trademarks owned by the various organizations. So,
but you can say them like in the context of a news story, though, right? I think.
Well, it depends. I mean, there is such a thing under trademark law as nominative fair use, mm-hmm. where you are able to reference somebody else's trademarks, but you really need to consult with a lawyer like me to tell you when you can and cannot do that, because it's pretty blurry sometimes, the
lines. Gina Martini is an intellectual property attorney with... Now the time to play the ad.
Did they say it was 600 million or billion dollars of lost productivity time? I think it was billion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
with all of us just watching the game.
I'll take the over.
They still have the official stream still has the boss button on it where you could drop the screen. But everyone knows everyone's watching it now. Like most companies now. I mean, one in our building was in the was featured in the Tribune, LaSalle Staffing yesterday, and the story was companies are just now embracing it because they know everyone's watching it. So they're having watch parties and why not?
There was a party in this building today, a WGN-sponsored party, but there was one in this building.
On the second floor, pizza and popcorn.
Where the nap pods are that I was going to
say. Milstein has a boss button, but it's for a completely different reason.
No,
you don't want to know what's going on that screen, believe me.
Fortnite, streaming Fortnite.
Yeah, that would,
No comment.
No comment. Thanks, guys.
Thank you for joining us. Good show.
Fun. And I'll just end off with saying... go get your shine box, Coyne.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this.